From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Former Vice President Joe Biden triumphantly entered a crowded field of Democratic candidates for president last week, brushing aside myriad criticisms. Biden's video announcement singularly focused on President Donald Trump's response to the Charlottesville, Virginia white supremacist rally and concluded that the 2020 election would be a, quote, battle for the soul of the nation. Polls have already begun to center Biden as the new frontrunner, and the Firefighters Union threw its weight behind him, shockingly early in the race. But many fear Biden's candidacy would trigger a repeat of the disastrous 2016 election race when Hillary Clinton narrowly beat Bernie Sanders for the Democratic nomination and then lost the Electoral College vote to Trump. We turn to Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who has written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, Raw Story, and more. He's author of the forthcoming book, Bacon is a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's also a regular news correspondent for our program. Welcome back, Arun.
Great to be with you today, Sonali.
So the criticisms of Biden are many and quite varied. They range from how he basically humiliated and undermined Anita Hill during the Supreme Court nomination debacle of Clarence Thomas, all the way to his vote for the Iraq War. And then, of course, the allegations around the Me Too movement and his inappropriate behavior with women. Many, many different criticisms. And he seems to feel like he has sort of addressed them all in announcing his candidacy, but has he really?
Certainly not at all. Anita Hill, for one, has said he has not been forthright about his conduct, and basically she was being put on trial during the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas in 1991, I believe. She was treated very hostily by the Democrats, and we have to remember that Clarence Thomas would not be on the Supreme Court if it was not for, I believe it was something like 10 Democrats who ended up voting for his nomination. It was a significant number of them. It might have been fewer, but the main thing is I think his corporate agenda. He's just another pro-war, pro-Wall Street candidate when it comes down to it. You know, all those videos of him touching women, touching little girls is just, I mean, it's creepy. There's no other way to describe it. It makes your skin crawl to see just his kind of sense of entitlement with women's bodies. And if that wasn't, you know, if that alone, that's bad enough. But I think the real issue is he is the candidate of the Democratic establishment. And the Democratic Party establishment really stands for nothing except neoliberal policies and management of American empire abroad.
Now, of course, already so early in the race, we seem to have these conversations, particularly among progressives who feel we have to beat Trump in the 2020 election race at any and all costs. And Biden, whether or not he is in line with our values, is our best bet for beating Trump, someone like Trump, because he could win over a wider swath of voters, because Bernie is too left. And of course, before Biden came into the race, the stand-ins for him were Peter Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. But now it's Biden, right? And how do you feel about this? Because we had some of these same conversations in 2016.
Well, it's also like, you know, the last decade hasn't happened. People forget that there was this guy named Barack Hussein Obama who became president in 2008, and he swept all these Midwestern battleground states. And I can tell you that Biden had absolutely nothing to do with that. Obama even won Indiana, which was extraordinary. That's a state that is over 80% white, and he managed to win that in 2008. Now, certainly a lot of that had to do with the sheer exhaustion of the Bush years, the Iraq War, Hurricane Katrina, the Great Recession. But nonetheless, the idea that it has to be this kind of like bumbling white guy who can is the only one who can resonate with a wide swath of voters is absurd. And the fact of the matter is like what I see happening all the time is like people making prognostications. You know, everyone thinks they can predict what's going to happen. And as someone who's actually in the business of political prognostications, I can tell you that you have no idea what's going to happen in 2020. No one can predict what's going to happen in the next week or two. The other thing is, though, Bernie Sanders does have huge support in these areas, and I've been through these areas. And in you know, a couple of years ago, I went and talked to the factory workers in Indiana at those Carrier plants where Trump said he was going to save those jobs. And a lot of them ended up voting for Trump. But of the Trump voters, what I found is nearly all of them liked Bernie Sanders better than they did Donald Trump. And that's the thing. You talk to working class voters, not just, you know, let's remember, let's not reduce working class voters to white male voters. The working class is majority female in this country. And then, of course, there are lots of African American and Latino working class. Many of them support Bernie Sanders, and they support him because of his policies. They support him because he was opposed to NAFTA, because he's opposed to corporate control of the economy, because he actually walks the picket line. So this and his campaign, Bernie Sanders' campaign, just released these internal polling shows him beating Donald Trump in the Midwest battleground states, some of them by double-digit margins, such as Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So what exactly is Joe Biden offering working class voters other than he's this like goofy white guy who likes guns?
Oh, he likes guns. I didn't actually know that aspect of him. You threw that
There.
in there at the very end. What does that mean?
Well, you know, in 2008, he actually came on and got some flack because he was in Pennsylvania campaigning towards the end of the election, and he was talking about, you know, that there's no way that Obama's going to take anyone's guns away from them, including him. So, you know, he does have this like he tries to play to this pro-gun crowd. You know, and so it's essentially his appeal is that it's a cultural appeal, and so it becomes this kind of like bizarre inverse of Donald Trump, you know, that or mirror of this is what the liberal media are doing is that they're basically saying that the white working class is hopelessly racist. So basically you need someone on who's a liberal centrist who can appeal to them like Joe Biden because he has to appeal to them in this very primitive way, rather than recognizing that what a lot of these white working class voters want is policy that affects their lives for the better. And that is not what Joe Biden is going to do. He's going to give banks greater control. He's going to give healthcare companies greater control, credit card companies. I mean, he's the senator from Delaware. Delaware is essentially a corporate front. That's the only reason this state exists.
So, Arun, the video that Biden used to announce his candidacy, as I mentioned, singularly focused on what you were saying, essentially a cultural issue, but a really important one, as you've been on the front lines of, and we have seen one attack after another on houses of worship just in the last few weeks that are really disconcerting and really play out in the way that you predicted would play out if we had Donald Trump as president, that we'd see these forces of white supremacy being unleashed. So isn't Biden's focus on that as a presidential candidate crucial?
It's important not to run away from the issue. You're right that this is a cultural issue. It's a cultural issue in part. You know, when I was covering the campaign in 2016, and I saw this white nationalism taking shape. And this is a little side point, but I think it's very important to make. There's this kind of rhetoric I hear all the time that, oh, Donald Trump was just exposing what's already there. That is completely untrue. He brought something very different into being. There wasn't this mass base of white nationalism that we now see in 2019. Where there's millions, tens of millions of people who are in favor of ethnic cleansing and this agenda. Now, I was writing about this in 2016, that was what he was going to do. He's brought something very different into shape. So you're right, it is a cultural issue, but it goes beyond a cultural issue. And it is this kind of intersection of class and race. Because what Trump was able to convince white voters, and this is across classes, right? It's not just working class, it's also middle class and upper class, is that the economy is being rigged against them, but it's being rigged against them by these brown hordes. So he would use this rhetoric, you know, Mexico Mexicans are stealing your jobs. We signed these bad trade deals. China is stealing your jobs. Everything is always in this racialized appeal that he's making. And so then we start to see, you know, now the whole replacement theory, right? White genocide, which is being promoted by Fox News, that white people are going extinct. What Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis were chanting, you know, very, very fine people, according to Donald Trump, Jews will not replace us. And now these shootings in New Zealand, the shooting that just happened in California, it's all about this replacement theory that, you know, or conspiracy theory, let's say. It's not... It shouldn't be called a theory because it has no credibility. But this notion that there's this agenda to replace white people, and they're being replaced by, you know, brown immigrants, by Muslims, by Jews, which is why we need to ignite this race war. So it's this kind of like amalgamation of culture and race and class. And it is very real. But I don't think that Biden certainly understands what's going on. I think the reason he picked this issue is it gave him a distinction because no one else in the Democratic field is going after Donald Trump on this issue. And I think it's very dicey. I don't think it should be ignored. I think, you know, Bernie Sanders is one of the ones who speaks out, and Elizabeth Warren, they've been speaking out very forcefully against Donald Trump's ethnic cleansing agenda and white nationalism, even though they don't use those terms. But if you don't understand how this kind of cultural grievances fit into race and class politics, then you're not really going to understand what type of solutions that people are looking for.
Right. And so there was a new poll recently that showed that by ABC and Washington Post that showed that, in fact, among the issues really important to voters is healthcare. You and I are talking on the day that Medicare for All is getting its first ever congressional hearing in Washington, D.C. And those are issues that candidates like Warren and Sanders have very much hedged their campaign platforms on, and Biden has not.
No, he's going to be the, you know, he's the senator from the healthcare industry. You know, he is pro-corporate control of healthcare. For-profit healthcare companies, medical device companies, pharmaceutical companies, the insurance industry can all count on him to block any attempt to have Medicare for all. And a couple of weeks ago, we had that extraordinary town hall where Bernie Sanders going on Fox News, and you have people, you know, a Fox News audience cheering Medicare for all. So this shows that there is just absolute widespread support support for this idea that at least part of the healthcare system, the insurance part of it, people want to see corporations cut out of that aspect.
In fact, that particular poll I mentioned said that those who picked healthcare as their top issue favored Democrats for Congress by 75 to 23%. So it's really interesting. This is a very important issue. So is the issue of immigration, apparently. Let's also talk about the special counsel report, the Mueller report. You and I haven't spoken since that report has come out. And I'm wondering if you think that that is an issue that has impacted Trump in the election and whether or not it becomes a campaign issue for Democratic candidates, certainly those who are already elected to office in the Democratic Party, have spent a lot of time focusing on that report, but they haven't decided whether or not they want to impeach Trump based on that report's findings. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I always thought it was a great distraction. I mean, you didn't need the Mueller investigation to know that this guy is a complete crook, the greatest grifter in world history. But it's clear that to me, in my opinion, and a lot of other more knowledgeable people in the legal field, that there is a very strong evidence of obstruction of justice on Trump's part. And there's this kind of idea floating around, oh, if there's nothing, if there's no crime, you can't obstruct justice. Well, that's absolutely absurd. It has to do with obstruction of justice is about a corrupt an intent to corrupt the administration of justice. And it's pretty clear Trump was open about that, that this is why he fired Comey, that he wanted to, that he fired Comey because of the Mueller investigation. He was going after Sessions publicly. He kept saying, if I knew that Sessions wouldn't recuse himself, I would have never picked him as my attorney general. And an impeachment process, we have to remember, is just it's the indictment process. So you're gathering information and then deciding to indict. It's the equivalent of a grand jury. So there's nothing to stop the Democrats from initiating an impeachment process. And I think politically, this idea that it would only help Trump is also ridiculous because during an impeachment process, you don't know what you're going to uncover. And once you start a fishing expedition, you can turn up all sorts of stuff, especially, his tax records, especially all the corruption, his dirty dealings with Deutsche Bank, and, his known dealing with
And
mobsters.
do you feel that that is important? Because, I mean, you started out saying that you thought it was a distraction, but I felt always that we do have this president who's a racist and who's part of the moneyed class, but he's also deeply, deeply, deeply corrupt, perhaps more corrupt than any other president in the history of the country. And that corruption should be a critical part of the opposition to him.
Well, the reason I'm saying that the Mueller report specific, I don't think investigations are a
I
distraction.
see.
I felt that the Mueller report, because it ended up being very constrained, and also Mueller's logic was pretty bizarre. He decided not to force a subpoena Trump to have because he said he needed to end the investigation in a timely manner. But that's just who said anything about a timely manner? The Iran-Contra investigation went on under Lawrence Waltz, the independent inquiry. That went on a full 6 years until it was finally kneecapped by the current Attorney General, William Barr, in December of 1992, when he convinced George Bush Sr. to issue all these pardons. There's no time limit set on these investigations. Yes, they would have had to have gone all the way to the Supreme Court to see if they could force Trump to testify, but they should have done that. And the fact of the matter is, he also didn't try to get any of his children to testify, even though they were at the infamous a Trump Tower meeting. So I think, Mueller was, I saw analysts saying, I think this is a correct take. Mueller was trying to protect in the end his own investigate his own reputation, which is why he curtailed the investigation. Now there's all sorts of other, we know that the special dis the District of New York is has something like a dozen or more investigations of Trump and the Trump organization underway. There are all these other inquiries going on, and we should see where they go. But I think it would actually be useful for Congress to begin its own impeachment proceedings, and they can also decide not to in the end impeach Trump. They can decide not to indict him. But let's see what the evidence let's see what evidence they can turn up.
One of the other polls around Trump have revealed, or poll results have revealed, that there's this interesting racial breakdown around impeachment. I don't know if you've seen this, but only 25% of white Americans think Trump should be impeached, compared to 69% of African Americans and non-whites in general. Nearly 60% think that Trump should be impeached. And I thought this was really interesting result to see this breakdown, racial breakdown for support for impeachment. What do you think?
I think part of that is probably can be attributed to that, obviously African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans are disproportionately Democrats, but that does not mean that they're, say, disproportionately, left liberals. I think part of it, and I'm just speculating here, maybe also this sense, if you're a person of color, especially if you come from a traditionally oppressed community, African American community, or Chicano community, Puerto Rican community, that the system is rigged in favor of white people, economically, and that how many of the so-called leaders, business leaders, and political leaders are just, enormous crooks. Some of the most celebrated figures publicly. How did Amazon get its start? It got its start by evading taxes. They illegally evaded taxes, sales taxes, for over a decade. Bill Gates engaged in a massive antitrust activity. Apple, it stole a lot of its early technology from the U.S. government, and it has some of the worst sweatshops in the world in Asia to make its iPhones. So a lot of the business titans are outright crooks, or at least highly unethical. So I think a lot of people of color understand this, and so they feel that someone like Donald Trump, who is clearly a crook, I mean, look at what's going on with the Trump Hotel in D.C. Where you have like the Saudis who are paying for like 100 rooms at a time, that's going straight into Trump's pocket. I mean, the corruption here is just breathtaking and open.
Right. Well, Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I know we'll have you on many times between now and the 2020 election. It's going to be a long year and a half. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Arun Gupta. He's an investigative journalist who's written for a number of publications, including Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. His forthcoming book is called Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's also a regular news correspondent for our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.